Today, we are having a brutally honest conversation about Hollywood with a real-life Hollywood insider. You will not want to miss this. Don't go anywhere.
Here's your host, Brendan Lauren Maxwell.
My guest today has worked as a producer and industry professional for 15 years. He has worked in development and production with companies such as Nickelodeon, Abrams Artists Agency, and Universal Pictures. He is a distinguished recipient of the Jack Kirby Award and is a dual graduate of New York School of Visual Arts and the American Film Institute in Los Angeles. His areas of expertise include development, production, IP management, and acquisition and distribution. He lives and works in Los Angeles. Please welcome to the show, Jordan Michael.
Hey, thank you, Brandon.
Thanks for joining me. I'm glad that we finally were able to get you on.
You're welcome. Great to be here with you and your audience. I know we've been talking about it for a while, so it's great to finally make it happen.
So let's start off with the industry. Like, what is the biggest myth that people come to Hollywood with?
The biggest myth, I think, that I have seen over and over again is that they fail to recognize that Hollywood, like almost everything else, is a system, right? We describe it by using the word studio system, right? Now, I always compare it to tools, right? If you're coming into Hollywood from the outside, you have a very limited set of tools. Like, think of it as tools on a tool belt, right? You maybe have a wrench, a hammer, and a screwdriver, right? Mm-hmm. People who come from the system, like within the system, and let's define that word system, right? System meaning the school ecosystem, because there are really two systems that feed into the Hollywood studio system, right? Which are the schools, that's one ecosystem, and the festival circuit, which is the second ecosystem. Both of those ecosystems have one thing in common. They're both led and founded and operated by people from the studio system world, from the television network world, from the major streaming world. And so the problem is, when you're coming in to Hollywood as an outsider with a screwdriver, hammer, and a wrench on your tool belt, there are people coming out of these schools and out of the festival circuit, or some people have even done both systems. They've done the school system and they've done the festival circuit system, and they have an entire tool kit on their belt, not just three tools.
Okay, so you're saying
it comes down to number of tools.
So you're saying that Hollywood draws primarily from two systems that it's worked with for a long time, and that system is the school system and the circuit. The circuit system being
festivals. Yeah,
okay. Well, and you're saying that people tend to come to Hollywood without realizing that, and they think they could just jump in another way.
Correct. Exactly. And now, I'm not saying that they can't do it any other way, but what I am saying is that there's a different system for those people, right? And it's a brand new system. It's the YouTube social media star system, right? Which doesn't require knowledge of the other two systems. It doesn't require swimming in those waters to get into the bigger ocean, right? The YouTube social media, influencer world is a fresh new world. It's the grass is super green there. There's lots of opportunity there. You just have to know that the YouTube, influencer star system has limits. The same way the indie world has limits. I tell people, have you ever seen an indie filmmaker make a $5 million movie? No. Because at that level, you need to have the advantages of the bigger studio system, which, again, it feeds in directly from the systems that we just spoke of a minute ago, the school ecosystem and the festival circuit ecosystem. So you can be an independent filmmaker and make great indie films over and over and over again, but you're not going to hit that threshold beyond that, because beyond that, a certain budget level, you need a studio. I tell people, you can't make Jurassic World as an indie film. You can't make Avengers as an indie film. You need a studio. You need a streaming service. You need a network for these bigger projects. If all you want to do is indie projects that are a certain budget level, that's just fine. Make those projects over and over again. Those projects have value. Those projects have audiences. But you're not going to get to that bigger level without being in that system, that bigger system that comes from a theater feeder platform.
Okay, well, I think you hit something on the head. You said network, and I think that's something that a lot of people don't understand. One of the things that those systems provide is a network of people to, I guess, work with, a network of people who have connections. What's the power of a network?
Let me be clear. Network, and the way I just mentioned, was like studio as in film, network as in television, platform, streaming service as in streamer, right? So those are the big three platforms. But yes, what you're saying, those systems do provide a network, right? One of my favorite examples, Derek Connolly and Colin Trevorrow did two of those systems, right? They both went to NYU, and then after they got out of NYU, they reconnected as interns on SNL, and they wrote and directed this movie in 2012 that a lot of people liked called Safety Not Guaranteed, and that won Sundance. Yeah, so it was one system feeding into another system, and then with both systems completed, they literally rocketed into the big leagues, because what was their next movie? Jurassic World, right? So those are people who literally did both systems and did both systems well enough that they were able to pole vault their way into mega success, right? But again, people ignore their bias. Colin and Derek made a great movie. I have friends in common with Colin and Derek because we come from that same New York. Well, they did undergrad in New York. And, you know, I'm like, wait a second. They paid all this money to go to NYU. If you look at the tuition of NYU or any of the major schools, you know, it's not cheap. So they paid to get into one system, and then they used the tools that they got at one system to enter another system. And that second system landed them where they wanted to be, which is in that big studio arena. Right. So you're literally paying for connections, because who's teaching at these big schools? Like literally Spike Lee runs the master's program at NYU. He can get you your first interview with Netflix or DreamWorks or Amazon, like with a phone call. Right. But you're literally having to be in that program to be around Spike enough for him to see your work, get to know you, and then make that phone call for you at the end of your graduation in 2 years. Right. That's something that the indie crowd that comes from outside the system is not going to have. That's a tool that they do not have on their tool belt. Again, they do show up with tools, but those tools are very limited in comparison to people they're competing for opportunities with from the two different ecosystems with a lot more tools.
Okay, so don't you think that this is part of the problem, if you would say that there's a problem in Hollywood with bringing fresh talent or people specifically from communities of color? Because a lot of people who come from lower income communities, a lot of the Latino community, a lot of the Black community, they might not necessarily have the resources to pay to go to a nice school, a film school with connections, or get into a festival where you have to pay a certain amount of money to enter a screenplay. Is this not a problem?
It certainly is a concern because the schools are, when they say the Film Ivy League, they're talking about five schools, right? USC, UCLA, the American Film Institute, NYU, Columbia, right? Those are like commonly referred to as the Ivy League of film school. Now, the problem is that if you look at the economics of and the demographics of people in those schools, they are commonly kind of one type of person, one kind of profile of person, if you will. And it is a problem, but here's the thing. Those bigger schools at those bigger levels are looking for a lot of those programs are grad school programs, right? So like the NYUs, the Columbias, the AFIs. Where are they looking? The undergrad programs. The problem with the undergrad programs is that they're going to say, well, people don't have a real strong enough to get into the big grad programs because they don't do strong enough work at the undergrad level. And where does that come in? Latinos and African American kids being told by their parents, by their community groups, by their peers, there's no place for you in that world. So you shouldn't major in film in college. There's no place for you there. So since you didn't do the work in undergrad, then you can't really do the work in grad school. And that's the thinking, right? So, and I saw that firsthand, right? In my undergrad film program, I was one of the two Black kids in the entire program, right? And the other person who was of color was a woman. At the American Film Institute, I was the only Black male producer in the producing program in my year. What does that say? it's because they're not able to pull from a strong undergrad crop of people who have the skills, the training, the familiarity with the internships and the industry to be able to bring them to that bigger grad school level where you're interacting with these high-level teachers from the big network studios and the streamers.
Okay, so that's interesting. So what would you say that the difference was between you and other people who might be Black or Latino that aren't in those programs? Was it money? Was it the fact that your family encouraged you to go into the program and take that risk? Was it that you were willing to take that risk? What's the difference?
I think the difference simply is the fact that I knew I wanted to do movies when I was very, very young. And I would watch like all the behind the scenes stuff I could get my hands on in high school, right? So one of the behind the scenes was the X-Men commentary for X-Men 2. And Bryan Singer had mentioned that he went to the School of Visual Arts, and I started researching School of Visual Arts, and I found out that it was founded by a lot of the Marvel people, like, you know, Jack Kirby and all these other people were heavily involved in Marvel. So I went to School of Visual Arts in New York, and it allowed me to be near my family. My dad's family is from New York. And it was just me like saying, I want this for myself, because I've known that I've wanted to do it for such a long time when I was very young. So I got lucky because I knew what I wanted to do very young. And I had enough self-confidence to say, I know it's a risk, but I'm going to take the risk because I like challenges. Mm. Because I could pick anything else, you know, I could pick anything else that's probably easier. But I like challenges. I like testing myself. I like pushing myself. And I like being creative. I like also having a handle on turning creative ideas into, you know, commerce. And Hollywood is a great place to kind of do that. Now, that's not to say that there aren't people going to, like, some of the smaller programs, right? Like, you know, I'm not going to name names, but the smaller programs, right? Now, but here's the thing with the smaller programs. In my experience, I tell people, can you name someone writing, directing, or producing a major Hollywood production at the studio level, network level, streaming level that comes from these smaller places, right? Or less well-known places? I can't think of one. And if I can't think of one, that tells you your answer. Yes, the smaller schools have better diversity in terms of kinds of people that go there, but the question comes down to what is the quality of that education, right? For example, I tell people who come from some of these smaller schools, can you tell me the difference between senior debt financing and mezzanine financing and foreign pre-sales and product placement and gap and super gap financing? That's like four or five different types of financing I just named. Can you tell me the differences and the advantages between all those different kinds of financing? Because I took a class on that at the American Film Institute, film finance and marketing. That was an entire year and a half class, right? So I know that stuff because I literally paid AFI level tuition to learn that stuff from the very beginning. Right. So I didn't have to sit there and learn by a trial and error, which a lot of these people from the smaller schools are going to have to do. Mm. They're going to have to learn, because here's the thing. I literally paid experts to tell me in a classroom what the difference is between those five types of financing and what's the most advantageous and how do you build a financing package. These other people who come from the smaller schools or come from outside the system, they have to learn that by messing up a whole lot. Right. Trial and error a whole lot. So that's really the bigger difference. They have to spend years making mistakes and trying to learn through haphazardness, where my classmates and I and other people who come from the bigger schools do not. We literally had a teacher sit there with us for an entire year, giving us homework, giving us exercises, bringing in guest speakers to talk about these complex topics. That's the advantage we have. Our tool belt is so much more full of different tools that the people outside the system trying to get in and people from the smaller institutions simply do not have.
So that's the school system. Explain why there's so much emphasis in Hollywood on the award system, on the festival system.
Well, that goes right back. It's like a mirror image to the school system, right? Because here's the thing. Who's judging these these major festivals, right? Because like there are thousands of festivals out there, right? And they all have something to offer. But what is it, what they have to offer, what the person entering is going to look for, right? When we say the festival circuit, we're talking about the major places everyone's heard of, the Sundances, the Tribecas, you know, the Tellurides. But I tell people, remember, Sundance was founded by Robert Redford, Hollywood insider, and Tribeca was founded by Robert De Niro, Hollywood Insider, right? So they put emphasis on the festivals because it's the industry people telling itself or telling themselves what the next big thing is going to be. And these people are from the industry running a festival, telling other people in the industry, this is going to be the next big star. Colin Trevorrow and Derek Connolly are going to be the next big star. You know what I'm saying? That's why it's such a big deal. It's because these people who have had major industry success for years start these festivals and are looking for the next big thing to tout.
So in
that's
a way,
why it's taken seriously.
Right. So in a way, it's validation from the industry pre-working
Correct.
In the industry. So would you say that a lot of these festivals and the money even that you pay to get into these festivals acts as a sort of filtering process?
Yeah, because, you know, I mean, some people are going to enter and find a way to raise that money, and some people will not. And if they're not able to raise certain money to pay the submission fee, then they're just not ready or they're just not serious enough to do it. So it does act as a barrier, and barriers are good, right? Certain barriers need to exist for a reason. Again, it's like American Idol, right? It's like what gives the American Idol winners credibility? Who are the judges of American Idol? These major industry stars, right? Who are going to comment on their chances of success because they've seen it and they've done it. But yeah, I mean, those barriers exist. I think those barriers are needed. I think there should be some leniency with some of these barriers, right? Because some of these smaller festivals have great work in them, right? But they don't get the legitimacy of the bigger places because really, who are the programmers? Who are the judges that they're bringing on to bring that festival legitimacy, right? It's like the smaller school problem. The smaller schools could be very critically acclaimed if they bring on what? The right professors. So again, it's all down to this credibility issue that people have to fight against. How are you credible? And how does the industry think you're credible? And that goes to another point. You can exist outside the system, right? I mean, there are plenty of great filmmakers who exist and have careers outside the system, right? They're just not able to get to a certain level of kind of studio, network, streamer, big level of success because they're refusing to play in that sandbox, if that makes sense.
But can you play in that sandbox if you already chose to forego the school system, for example? Like, what if you're 40 years old and you want to make a film or you want to get into Hollywood? Maybe through a screenplay or through a film, what route do you have? Are you limited at that point to, I guess, a festival way of the festival, or is there any other type of back way in there?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's, you know, I mean, there's a couple ways, right? I mean, like one way is like the guy who did Vast of Night, right? That guy, he directed commercials for years and years, saved that money from directing commercials and producing commercials, and used it to make his first feature. It did well at the festivals, and Amazon bought it, right? Some people come in from the industry with a lot of resources, right, a lot of money, and they'll hire, perfect example, Netflix, right? They come in as a newcomer in Hollywood, but what's one of the first things they do? They bring on experienced people from the studios and the major networks, right? And they have them working for Netflix now. So now Netflix is instantly legitimate because they're bringing on the names, star executives, right? So there's a way to do it. I mean, if you have enough resources behind you or the right resources behind you, those are different, then you can make an impact. And the schools are not going anywhere. See, I mean, some of my classmates at AFI were in their 40s when they went to AFI. So the schools aren't going anywhere either. It's just, you know, more difficult in certain ways too, right? Yeah. I mean, one of my best friends was in his 40s. Went back to school at AFI for directing because look at it's in Hollywood, look at the teachers teaching there, look at the guest speakers speaking there, look at the technical resources you have access to, right? That's worth it for him.
Do you think, so there's a really big push right now, I think, to eliminate a lot of the barriers to get into Hollywood. What happens without barriers, in your opinion? Because you said some barriers are good. So are there good barriers and bad barriers? Are all barriers good? Are all barriers bad? How do you view barriers?
Yeah, I think there needs to be a selection process, right? Barrier is just a crude term for selection process, right? Because what is the selection process of the people you work with look like? I mean, I have a producer friend who went to two Ivy League schools, right? His criteria is he will only work with people from the, either you have to have graduated from one of the major schools, and you also have to have won one of the major festivals. The reason why is because of the fact that he's like, what happens if some indie filmmaker comes without that stuff and wastes my time, you know, not being serious? Because here's the thing. If you're going through that festival circuit, if you're going through those major schools and paying all that money to go through those major schools and enter in those major festivals, you're proving that you're serious. If you don't do that stuff, there's always going to be a second question about, is this person really serious? Do they really know what the industry entails enough to actually do it for the long haul? Because what happens if the director writes this really great script and then one day wakes up while in development on the script and says, you know, I'm going to use my other background and go back to my job in tech in San Francisco. You know, it was fun, but see you later. Because I've actually had a friend of mine who's an investor have that happen, right? Where was the barrier for that person, right? So it's built that way by design to make it difficult. So when you do get over that ladder, when you do get to the promised land, there's a reason you're getting to a certain level. It's because you have the experience and you have the drive to level up.
We were talking a bit about that announcement that was recently made that for films to qualify for an Oscar, they have to hit a certain benchmark in terms of diversity.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of general audience people, of course, lauded that as a really big win. They said it was proof of Hollywood making strides. You had a different take on it. You basically said that it was smoke and mirrors, and I'm curious to hear your explanation again as to why, so listeners can understand.
Well, I think it's a very good attempt. You know, I think it's a very good attempt. I think it signals that something needs to change. I think that people will go, and this is not exactly a great comparison, but I think people are going to do what they call the letter of the law, not the spirit of the law, right? So they'll place a woman or they'll place someone on the producing team to win the Oscar, but not for the right reason. It's to win the Oscar. And if that person is literally the definition of token by being there for no other reason, then they get an award for that. I think it's ill-intended. Now, some people will follow the letter of the law. I'm waiting to see who's going to follow the spirit of the law. Who are you going to invite on your producing team for the right reason and as to why? That's what I'm waiting to kind of see. It's too early to kind of tell, but we're going to see who actually will satisfy the letter of the law and who will satisfy the spirit of the law, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. And something else, I think it was you that had brought up, was that part of the reason they focused on the Oscars was that that's the most visible arm of Hollywood, but maybe not necessarily the most effective place to make a change.
I mean, I understand it's a visibility issue, right? Because people are saying, oh, it's this, it's that, it's visibility. And the Oscars are the most visible part of Hollywood, right? Everyone watches them. They're huge in the ratings, you know, whatever else, right? But what is that doing for what I call the mechanics of Hollywood, right? The behind the scenes, you know, gear and wrench part of Hollywood that makes Hollywood go. Is it changing anything as far as that? I'm not really sure, right? Because you can change the tower at the top. You can change the light on the lighthouse, but what's the base of the lighthouse that makes it run, right? I think we're solving one problem and not focusing on the other problem because we're solving the most visible part, the top of the lighthouse. Where is the solving of the bottom and the engineering of that lighthouse?
Right.
That's what I say.
Sure.
Right.
You point to Tyler Perry a lot as an example of somebody who you feel is doing Hollywood on his own terms and in the right way.
Yes. I think Tyler Perry is a brilliant businessman. He knows how to, he makes a product that his audience really likes and they identify with. And that's, and really he makes a good product, you know, for the audience that he's working towards and working for. He makes a great product that they understand, that they feel connected with. And I always tell people his budgets get bigger. He gets stronger technically every single time. I mean, it's been amazing to see what he's been able to build on his own without all of that. I tell people you can fit five of the studios inside of Tyler Perry's Atlanta compound and still have 80 acres left over, right? He took control in his own. He took control of his own career. He didn't have the agents and managers kind of coming after him in the beginning of his career. Here's what he did. He actually, and this is something he told me once when he called me right after graduation from AFI. His office called me. His team was very, very kind to me. And what they told me was, you know, look, Tyler brought half of the money for Diabomed Blackwing, which he wrote and produced, right? So when you bring half of the money to a production, you're automatically a partner, right? So the studio was like, okay, so you brought half the money, we'll bring the other half and we'll provide marketing and distribution, but you're already a partner with us because you brought it. You've already done the hard part. You brought half the money, therefore reducing and negotiating our risk, right? That's the smartest thing he's ever done. A lot of indie filmmakers think, I have a script, I need to find a studio that will pay for all of it. Well, first of all, you know, that's great, but that's not realistic for your first couple movies. You can have different financing structures in place that make you a partner to a studio from your very first movie. Just bring half the money or not even that, you know, you bring half the money and you bring distribution, and all you need the studio for is marketing, helping you do prints and advertising. Mm. Right. So there's that too. It's a different way. There's different ways of kind of, you know, combining the forces to make something happen. The problem is, again, this goes back to the school system and the festival system. The people who know these different combinations are in those schools and in those festivals. That's the problem. Because where is that information available to a wider audience of filmmakers who want to do movies?
What do you say to people who complain that so many bad movies are getting made in Hollywood? How does a bad movie get made in Hollywood when they're so particular about the people that they work with? Is that a problem?
Well, I always
of a bubble.
I don't think I tell people, you know, and this has been a criticism I've heard for 1,000 years now. It's like people say, "Oh, the studios don't make movies." I was like, "Well, let's be clear. The studios, and we say the studios, we mean like the group of people, you know, companies in power in Hollywood. The studios may not get it right all the time. That's true. We've proven that. We've seen that." But they know how to make movies because they've been doing it for 100 years. So they may not make interesting movies all the time, content wise, but they know the technical process of how to make a movie because they've been doing it collectively for 100+ years. Right. Mm-hmm. So let's say that first. Now, no, I tell people my comparison is nobody wants to make a good movie the same way no one wants to go on a bad date, right? A bad, quote, bad movie becomes bad as it goes along. The same way a bad date doesn't start out bad, it becomes bad as it goes along.
Mm-hmm.
Through all these different choices that are made that impact the date, right?
Yeah.
And then you come out of that date saying, I never want to do this again. But no one signs onto a bad movie thinking it's going to be bad.
Sure.
Because who's ever done that, right? It becomes bad, again, like the bad date. You dress up, you pick a nice restaurant, you pick a great movie afterwards, and you go on this first date with someone that you've met, and you want to see how this goes. It becomes bad as the night goes on, and that's the difference. Just like a bad movie. Everyone making this movie signed on to make something good because they want to be proud of their work. It becomes bad as choices are made as you make the movie and then as it gets released. That's what I will say to those people.
Sure, and movies are an incredibly collaborative process. Would you say that that's something that people who go into Hollywood have an unrealistic view about? For example, they have their first screenplay, they approach an agency or they talk to a studio, but they don't want to mm-hmm. make any changes to their screenplay or to their film.
I see that all the time. I see that all the time. Because people are like, you know, this is my vision. Why don't you respect my vision? Why don't you want to replicate my vision on screen? But what studio or network or streamer has a like? Do they have is it in their constitution to replicate what they are essentially paying for in your image? No, their constitution says they're going to replicate what they see on the page in their own image with their own ideas, that sort of thing. That is their mandate. That is their constitution. And that's, again, the difference is when you're in school, when you're in the festival circuit, you're exposed to that kind of thinking and how they think about that, right? The people coming in don't know that because they haven't been taught that. They haven't done the internships at the studio or the agency to see that. They don't know those professors that work at professor who works at Paramount or Sony or Disney or Warner Brothers when they're not teaching you at the big school. who tells you that this is what I'm looking for at the studio. If anyone knows anyone that has something like this, let me know. Right. So it just comes down to misunderstanding. They just don't understand the system well enough to really play in that system.
Do you think there's there's a disconnect sometimes between the artist and the business of creating art?
Yes. And that's in every artistic field since the dawn of time, right? What the artist wants to accomplish is not what the corporate entity wants to accomplish, right? But here's the thing that our artists seem to not realize about creating art, right? So when you create art, when you're first starting out, you're creating what you create and you hope people buy it, right? Because it comes from your heart, comes from your soul, and you're hoping that people will buy it, right? As you grow in success, what are you having to do? You're now having to adjust what you make to respond to what your fans ask for, what they want to hear or watch you make, right? So Marvel starts out making films a certain way. But by the end of their 22 arc with Infinity Endgame, at that point, they're making what the fans are asking them to make. And because that's what the fans are willing to pay for. The fans are like, here's the deal. We'll tell you what you want to make and we'll support you with what you want to make as long as you make what we want. And Marvel says yes. You know, these other groups will say yes. But you don't start off that way. And that's the part that creative scene, that there's a disconnect between that. There's a disconnect between the start of your career where you can make whatever you want because there's no expectations, versus like year 5, year 10 of your career, where you're actively listening to the audience who are telling you what they want to see you make and they'll pay for it.
What role do agents play in Hollywood, and are there any myths surrounding the role that agents play?
Oh boy! Well,
I've heard you talk about agents a lot. You've mentioned agents a lot, and you've mentioned to me before that you see a lot of writers who think that they're going to find an agent and it's just going to solve all of their problems. And right. You know, even after me knowing you for a few years, you changed the way that I looked at agents.
Yeah, I think agents are looked at like as these fairy godmothers who will just wave the magic wand to make all your dreams come true. I mean, I know a writer friend who has a friend who was signed. He and his writing partner, this third party, was signed to one of the big agencies and actually had a really great script that I was thinking about jumping on board as producer. Right, it was a retelling of Oliver Twist with superpowers. Right. And the third party writing team, one of them was working at the Apple store and was doing that as like a survival job to pay bills, right? And he thought, oh, I got signed to this big agency. They like my Oliver Twist and superpowers script. My work is done, right? But what he didn't realize is that the work is just beginning. The agency wants rewrites. They want you to take meetings. They want you to do different rewrites. Can you work up a series Bible in case they want to make it a series? Can you do rewrites with this star in mind? All this other work. I mean, I tell people, the writer thinks that when they get an agent, they have a script, that the work is done, when the work is just starting to begin, to begin, to begin. Mm-hmm. And I also tell people, you know, your agent, typically, not all the time, but typically, your agent's not going to give you your first writing job. You'll win the student Oscar, you'll win the student Emmy, you'll win some big award, and they'll get you your second and third and fourth writing or directing job, right? So they're not going to give you a first job because what can they use to argue, right? Because I always tell people, everything is either an argument, a compromise, or a negotiation, right? How are they able to argue on your behalf if you haven't done anything? Again, this is where the schools and the festivals come in handy, because everything at that level is an argument when you're starting out. Everything is a justification. How can your agent at CAA or William Morris or UTA or ICM justify you directing the next big blockbuster if you haven't had a Sundance win? Again, the Colin Trevorrow, Derek Connolly example, right? So it comes back to the work in the right way. If you do good enough work, it's strong enough for me to argue on your behalf the next time, but you got to help me out. Again, if you want me to sell this, you know, if you want me to sell you to a network, you have to write something a network wants to buy. So if they want the next, what has happened to a friend of mine? It's like, you know, you get the call. Do you want to write the next Harry Potter for $1 million, but you have to have it to me in 6 weeks? Well, I can't do that. Well, then I can't sell you, you know? Fine, right? One of my friends turned down directing Captain America 2, right? Because he just, you know, that he just felt he couldn't. So, but that's also part of it too. You also have to know yourself well enough to know what you can do and what you can't do, because don't go for what you can't do because people are pressuring you, because it's what you can't do. And you know yourself well enough to know that.
Yeah. And with agents, I don't think a lot of writers think about the fact that you're not just competing sometimes against all the other writers, but sometimes you're competing against the other writers who that agent also oversees, because you're competing for their time. So if they have more, you know, a bigger writer on their roster, they're spending more time trying to find that writer gigs, because that's more money for that agent.
Correct. And that looks better to their boss, right? So, you know, it's a competition with lots of fish and the tank, right? Which fish are you pulling out of the water to kind of, you know, serve to people, right? So, it's a tough process with agents and managers. But here's the thing. Writers convince themselves that they need agents and managers. And people ask me, you know, if you could compare agents and managers to one thing, what would it be? I always tell people it's the phone company, right? The phone company has literally, and there's only four phone companies, right? The same, well, now there's three, right? Because Sprint and T-Mobile merged. But the same way that there's only four agencies, right? ICM, UTA, CAA, and William Morris, never the big four agencies, right? They have literally become like the phone lines in this business. If you want to get messages to people, if you want to get things back and forth in this business in any meaningful way, it's through an agency, right? They're like the phone companies. They're like the internet companies, where everything goes through them and there are limited choices if you want certain kinds of access. Mm. Yeah.
So how do you recommend new writers, how should they view agents? Should they go into the industry and not even look for an agent and wait to be approached by one? Or should they spend time trying to find one that fits their needs? What do you think from your perspective?
See, I tell people the age of the journeyman, whatever it is, writer, director, producer, I feel like that's kind of like the sun is setting on that. If you're just a writer and that's all you do, that the sun is setting on that thing, because now you're expected to really do it all, right? I say to people, if it's a small script, why do you need an agent? Again, you don't need an agent the same way you don't need a studio to make Little Miss Sunshine. Because think about it, every Sundance movie is made without an agent. If you think about it, everything that's winning Tribeca, Sundance, all these things, they're usually made 99% of the time, 95% of the time, without the involvement of the studios, networks, agencies, or streamers. How do they do it, right? They make it. A lot of writers are not really comfortable making anything. That's not their expertise. Mm-hmm. Their expertise is writing. But to have a career in 2020, 2021 Hollywood, you have to be able to make something. And really, my justification is, I was like, you know, what's stopping you from raising $1.5 million to make Moonlight? What's stopping you from raising $200,000 to make Little Miss Sunshine? Like, what's stopping anyone from doing that? Yes, something is stopping you from making Jurassic World and Avengers, and we know what that is. But nothing is stopping you from making Salmon Fishing in the Yemen. Nothing is stopping you from making Midnight Special. Nothing is stopping you from making Moonlight. You can go out and raise that money to make those movies, and you make them, and there it is.
But to raise money, you need to have connections.
Not really. I mean, there's a bunch of film finance conferences that go on every year. Now, do I see independent producers and writers at those conferences? No, I don't. Who do I see? The insiders, right? The people from the circuits, right? So there's money out there, right? For people who want to make projects in film and media. They just don't know. Either they don't know, or they're not prepared. Either they don't know about those conferences and they just don't and never heard of them, or they're not prepared to walk those conferences. I mean, literally, you know, you get invited to the Film Finance Festival and you don't have a budget and schedule. How are you going to go to that festival and actually make a meaningful impact with that time and with those resources if you don't have the paperwork ready?
Well, you're a line,
like tax credits,
right? So for our listeners that don't know, you work as a line producer, which does budget and scheduling for films. So you look at things through the context of a line producer. Explain to our listeners the importance of a line producer and what role they play in films, and how they're different from a producer.
Yeah. So the line producer is like the person in charge of the nuts and bolts, right? So the line producer is doing the schedule, how many days you're shooting, doing the budget, what the cost of the shoot will take, hiring crew, getting permits, hiring location managers, doing insurance cert paperwork, all of that, like the nuts and bolts of the production is the line producer. And they're not really involved in like the creative, right? They're not involved in like the casting. They're not involved in hiring the director. They're not involved in any of that, right? So I did the producing program at the American Film Institute, but when I was there, the program was in a half and half, what they call a half and half kind of setup, where half of the program was line producing, training you how to become a really great line producer, but the other half was creative as well, working with the director, working with the writer, you know, picking the cast, having conversations with the director on the cast, that type of thing, right? So those are the differences. The producer, in contrast to the line producer, the producer is the one that champions the movie start to finish, script to screen, and all the elements work together to make the best picture, which is why the producer wins the best picture at the Academy Awards every year, because it's the elements that make that film up to make the best picture overall. That's the producer who's doing that.
So if you have one piece of advice that you would give somebody who's getting into the industry, what would it be?
Surround yourself with really good people who will be honest with you. I mean, what I mean by that is, you know, look for the people who are going to be honest with you about the work, but then also you want to find people who you're able to really work okay with that are honest, because, you know, those two things are different. People who are great to work with are not always the people with the best perspective, right?
Sure.
But I also tell people, you know, it depends on what you want. If you want to, I mean, I listened to your earlier podcast with your colleague, Kenneth, and really to some of my industry friends who listened to your podcast, that episode, they were confused by what some of the stuff he said. He's had, how many features has he done? He's done 7 or 8, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
He's done 7 or 8 features. He's self-financed them. They're in Target. They're in Walmart. I mean, to most people, Kenneth is living the dream. I mean, how many filmmakers are trying to get their short or feature into a festival? He's found a way to outdo all of that. He's made his movies his way with money he's raised and has them in major retailers for sale. I mean, isn't that the dream? Isn't that what everyone really secretly wants? So it just depends on what that person coming in really wants. Do they want a Hollywood career where you have a 5-picture deal with Paramount and a television output deal with Netflix? Do they want that kind of career? Or do they want the career like your colleague Kenneth, where I just want to be able to do my work my way and get it to the audience that wants to see it? Those are very different ecosystems.
Right. So you're saying
again,
that there's
bringing us back to that system.
Right. So you're saying there's two different tracks, basically.
Yeah.
And so what about somebody making the jump from one track to another? Because I think what Kenneth and other filmmakers want, who have made their own films, who've been making their own films, getting their own films distributed, might have films even on Amazon or Netflix. What they want is opportunities to make bigger films with bigger budgets, with bigger talent, and not to be ignored. And are you saying that the reason those opportunities don't come is because they're in a separate track or ecosystem?
Ecosystem, yes. It's a different ecosystem because the people who want those bigger opportunities go through the system, right? I mean, if I'm at Knott's Berry Farm, and Knott's Berry Farm is great, but is Knott's Berry Farm Disneyland? No, they're different systems. Yeah, Knott's Berry Farm has great amenities and great attractions, and I can pay this price for it, and it's great. But if I really want Disneyland, I'm going to have to fork over some more resources to get that different experience. Ecosystem. The Knott's Berry Farm ecosystem is similar in a lot of ways, but very different to the Disneyland experience and ecosystem. But people know, the people who are going to Disneyland know they're going to Disneyland and they're not going to Knott's Berry Farm and vice versa.
So I guess the critique...
If that makes sense.
Sure, it makes sense. But I think the critique that most people are going to give, particularly people of color, people from marginalized economic communities that, you know, aren't necessarily rich communities, they're going to say, what about us? Like, how do we even get into that ecosystem without the money to get into it? There's no money to get into the ecosystem. Because basically right now, what you're saying is you need to have money to get into the ecosystem.
Well, I mean, we have to pay a certain premium to get into Disneyland, right? I mean, well, how, if I can't afford to go to Disneyland, where do I go? Well, Knott's Berry Farm is open,
right? Well, you've said that you're interested in doing indie producing. So is that to say that you also, you don't mind working outside the system yourself if you were going to be into producing a picture?
Yeah, I don't mind working in the indie system, sure. I mean, I think the biggest difficulty with the indie system is people just can't make up if they really want to make this movie or not. I mean, you know, they just don't know if they want to really do this. And again, that's out to people outside the system who don't have the experience being groomed by one of the systems that know they want to really do this. So, I mean, I've been in the room where the investor says, I'll give you $25 million right now to start a production company, get office space, hire a small staff, and you have to do three features, and I want a series. And I'll give it to you right now if you can tell me how you're going to spend that money on this operation. And the indie filmmaker said, you know, we really just want to make this $500,000 documentary right now. You sound like you want to run a business. This is an after-school project for us. And I turned and I looked at these indie filmmakers. So I'm like, so we're going to get this kind of offer on the table, and we're going to walk away because someone's expecting something of us? I think that's terribly, terribly short-sighted, right? So that's the challenge I see in the indie world, is that people are so obsessed with getting the meeting, but then when the meeting doesn't go exactly the way that they expect, they're not able to compute how to move forward. Again, those two filmmakers that have the $25 million offer to actually make a company. Because here's what a lot of indie filmmakers don't understand, right? It's not hard to get money. Not as hard as they think, right? Here's the secret. A lot of these banks, like, for example, Comerica Bank has an entertainment lending operation, right, where they lend to filmmakers to make projects, but they want to see a slate, right? They want to see 5 to 7 films that you have budgets and schedules for, and they'll give you whatever money you need. Because here's the thing. Let's say if two movies do badly, one movie does okay, one movie does good, but then one movie is a breakout success and it pays for all the other movies,
yeah.
Right?
That's music,
basically,
yeah.
If you think about that,
yeah music works the same way. Yeah.
Right. That's basically a studio. They'll get behind their odds on that, right? Because it's 7 chances to make a hit. If I'm paying for one indie documentary for $500,000, which, by the way, $500,000 is unheard of for a documentary, right, at the time. But if I'm going to spend my money on that and that doesn't get distribution, I'm literally out $500,000. I'd rather spend bigger money and take bigger chances than smaller money and take no chances. Because here's the thing. These investors want to see, they want to feel like they're taking a good risk. Mm-hmm. That's how they got where they are. So the money is out there. People just don't have the paperwork or don't have the vision to go get that money and can't speak the money language. That's what I see over and over and over and over again.
What's the mindset of the average movie investor? Is it purely driven by money, or is some of it driven by prestige? Is some of it driven by a love for the arts? Is it a combination of the three?
I feel it's a combination. In my experience, it's been a combination of the three. I mean, they think it's cool to say I'm investing in a movie that's going to Sundance. Let me walk the step and repeat, you know, let me bring my girlfriend on the red carpet, whatever they feel they want to do with that opportunity. Right. But they also do want to see good work. So it's a mix of, can you sell me on your A, content, B, ability to follow through on that content, and C, what festival circuits are we going to be hitting? Are we going to be hitting Tribeca, Sundance? I got to make sure I have something to talk about in the alumni newsletter. You know, it's a mix of those things. But filmmakers don't speak that language. That's the thing. They're not really able to articulate what the investor concerns are. Again, they can't even show up with a really good schedule and budget to present to investors when investors are looking for stuff. I mean, there is a guy for years that would write me every January and every August saying, you know, he controlled a film fund. And they would do up to 50 to 75% financing with this film fund. They just have to see a budget, schedule, a script, and a log line and a cast list, right? And every year, he would write me in January and August of every year for like the last 4 or 5 years and ask me, do you have anyone that's ready for me to look at? And I always tell him the same thing, no. Because writers are still writing scripts, they're doing rewrites, they're doing all these things because writers will write forever. Like, that's what they don't under, like, writers will write themselves to death, if that makes sense. They'll never put the pencil down. You have to tell them to put the pencil down, because if you keep writing forever, there's never going to be a movie.
You know, there's a big push right now to change Hollywood. There's a lot of people who are saying that the old system is broken. I'm just curious to hear your viewpoint from having worked in the system and being somebody who's of color, how you view that system.
Well, I think it's an interesting system. I think it's a very kind of, some of it works, some of it may not work as well as intended type of situation, right, with that. But I also tell people, you know, Hollywood itself will probably never change, because it's too institutionalized to change, right? And the change that did happen to Hollywood was what? Simply a new player with different tools, right? Netflix, Amazon, Hulu. These are new players with all this resources coming in with a different tool set to make product. I always tell people, these places are not really studios. They're making product that resembles the studios. They're emulating the studios, but these are tech companies, you know, emulating the studios and what the studios did for so long, and only they did for so long, right? But how do you bring in diversity into that? Diversity really requires, diversity, as someone told me early in my career, diversity is expensive, because diversity by definition leads to conflict of some kind or some sort, right? And secondarily, diversity then slows you down. If you're a small operation, you literally can't afford diversity, because the only weapon you have if you're a small operation running on limited funds is time. And diversity drains you of time, because diversity creates conflict, right? The bigger companies that can afford the slowdown that diversity will bring can afford it, but do they want to do it? I mean, those are two different questions. They can afford it, but do they want to do it? You know, it's up in the air. It's being talked about. It's being questioned right now. So that's good. I always tell people, you know, let's reexamine these ideas, because they may not work 25 years ago and 20 years ago may not work now. So let's reexamine these ideas.
In what way does diversity lead to conflict? Are you talking economic diversity, cultural diversity, racial diversity? In what way does diversity lead to more conflict?
So I don't personally believe that is necessarily true, but someone who interviewed me for a job early in my career said, you're diverse, you have great ideas. You know, I was the only person in the company who didn't go to an Ivy League school. I went to an art college, right? He's like, but your ideas are different than everyone else's here, and that slows things down because it creates a conflict, right? Mm-hmm. So the smaller groups, I'm saying the smaller groups, diversity slows things down, because everyone's going to have a different perspective, and different perspective then leads, I have to investigate every perspective. We have to talk about every perspective. I mean, look at the time that's already being added up by those things alone. And then you times that times 5 or 10, right? The only real groups that can afford that from an economic standpoint, if I'm running a startup and I only have $5 million to run this company for 3.5 years, I really don't have time for diversity, because diversity, that kind of diversity, diversity of thinking, diversity of thought, that's going to drain my time. Because here's the thing with startups, right? They're already diverse by trying to do something different than the big players on the scene. And that's their diversity. It's thought diversity, not racial or economic or diversity in terms of experiences. Their diversity is, we're doing something differently than the big kids, and that's how we're different, and that's how we're going to be leading. Not with diversity.
So
that's the issue right there.
Well, aren't films like Black Panther an example of a film that can be successful while being pretty diverse?
That's true, but here's the big thing with Black Panther. Has there ever been another black superhero that's been on screen that has not been a Marvel superhero that's been successful?
Yeah, I know there's not one that comes to mind, but I mean, how many have been tried to be made? I guess, you know.
Well, lots have been tried to be made, of course, right? You know, lots have been tried, but all of them have, because yeah, they've all failed, right? A lot of them have failed before they even started, right? So Black Panther proves that things can be diverse, but Black Panther is also a Marvel superhero, Marvel with a capital M, gold plating behind logo, right? So it's I would tell you it's kind of a bad example because it's like Marvel, anything is gold these days. You know, we have to test that theory with a non-Marvel action character to see if it's true.
Do you think...
Because Black Panther had the bigger universe behind it, right? So there's that.
Well, do you think that Hollywood views it as a bad business decision to try to make a film too diverse because of, I don't know, whatever, maybe they think that the majority of moviegoers are white, even though almost, 40% of the country is not?
I have heard the argument that, for example, you know, I have heard in meetings at all, both the indie and senior level, we can't make this because, for example, Latino and Black kids will watch a Harry Potter movie with a white antagonist, but will white kids watch a movie with a Black or Latino protagonist? There's a question to that, right? That they wonder about. And the problem is that a movie of certain expense and certain marketing budget is too expensive to take the risk to answer that question with this big movie.
Okay, now I would...
That's the real issue.
Right. Now, I would think that Black Panther answered that on at least some type of superficial level. Again, like you're saying, that needs to be tested, but wouldn't the success of that movie suggest that you can have a Black protagonist and have white kids want to go see that film?
Yeah, but again, it goes back to the branding, right? Black Panther was a Marvel superhero with a huge following after Civil War. It was product placement within the product placement within the product placement, right? It's like, you know, so that it's kind of it's skewed results because Black Panther was not totally unknown. He had this huge introduction and the biggest movie of that year. I mean, it proves that it can work, but look at the buildup to Black Panther, right? Marvel branding. These friends, I mean, he was introduced at the El Capitan Theater. I remember I was there. Chadwick Boseman came out with Robert Downey Jr. and Chris Evans, two of the most popular superheroes in the world, are introducing this new Marvel character, right? So let's just look at the lead up into Black Panther. It was all stops pulled out to promote this new Avenger. Do other projects have that? No. And that's where people say, well, the results are skewed. Black Panther had all of this lead up into the movie that other projects don't have. And so we can't answer that question with skewed data of Black Panther. Because look at what Black Panther had. It's like, again, the whole thing with Quibi. It's like, you know, it's like people who started these Stanford dropouts who start these startups. Well, these Stanford dropouts raised millions of dollars. Right. But look at where they're coming from. They're dropping out of Stanford together and they're using these professors and connections they made at Stanford to raise all this money. We can't judge their results by the average person. The results are skewed. People will say, but they're dropouts. Right, but they're dropouts from Stanford after they made all these connections that allowed them to raise $20 million.
Jordan, always an interesting conversation with you. You never mince words, and that's why you're good to talk to about these subjects. You don't sugarcoat anything. You kind of just tell it as it is. It'd be interesting to get you on the show at some point with Kenneth so we can have these two different perspectives. And maybe we'll try to do that. I'll give him a call and we'll talk about that if you'd be up for that.
I'd be happy to have a conversation with him, sure.
Yeah, I think it'd be interesting just to hear both your perspectives from different parts of Hollywood. With that said, I thank you for coming on to the show and we'll have to have you back to talk more Hollywood at a future point.
I'd be happy to join you guys.
What's the best way that people can follow you online if they want to follow you?
Sure. So I have my Twitter, and my Twitter is at my name, Jordan Michael with no vowel. So it's at J-R-D, N as in Nancy, M as in mouse, C-H-L.
Thanks for coming on, Jordan, and we'll talk again later.
Okay, thanks for having me, Brandon. Take good care.
All right. So tough truths that come out of that conversation that in some ways might solidify what everybody has already suspected or feared. When we think about Hollywood and some of the problems that might exist in Hollywood, there is an insider's perspective. It doesn't sound promising that the system is going to change, but that doesn't mean that the system can't change. And it doesn't mean that there aren't people inside the system that don't think that it should change. So we'll have them back again. I hope you join me for the next show. I hope you enjoyed this show. Until then, make sure to subscribe to my new YouTube channel where you can watch this show live if you aren't listening to it on Spotify or iTunes. Make sure to follow me at my social media, which is B to the Max. Thank you for listening. Have a great week.